KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Of course, Eric Weiner isn't the first person to try and figure out genius. For decades and decades, people have been puzzling about what it is that makes a genius. One theory is that you were just born that way. Another is that genius comes through hard work and practice. But Weiner says for years we've been asking the wrong question. Rather than asking what makes a genius, he says the better question is where. Where is genius? Where is creativity? In his new book, he says it turns out geniuses don't just pop up randomly. They come in groups, in clusters. Think of Socrates and Plato and Aristotle in ancient Athens. Think of Michelangelo and Da Vinci in Florence. Today in the program, Eric Weiner will join us to talk about what he's learned about the conditions that make way for genius. And by the way, just who is a genius anyway? Join us after the news.
Stay connected with KUER throughout the day on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. We'll bring you stories from our local news team along with program updates and features from NPR, BBC, and other network providers. Get the scoop on upcoming events, meet your favorite public radio personalities, and find out what's happening at the station behind the scenes by following KUER on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his new book, the journalist Eric Weiner doesn't spend much time with the question of where genius comes from. You know, is it nature? Is it nurture? Is it hard work? Others have written about that. The question that interests him more is the where and the when of geniuses. Where do they turn up? Under what conditions? So he did this thing that he does as a journalist. He went on these journeys around the world to track it down. It's what he did with his book called The Geography of Bliss a few years ago. He went searching for the world's happiest places. You've got to admit, it's a pretty good excuse to travel. One thing that he did learn early on in this latest project is that geniuses don't just pop up randomly. They come in groups, in clusters. And not just that, they're competitive, but not too competitive. They're social, but not too social. They're outsiders, but not too far out. They don't usually fit in that well. They often walk. They sometimes drink, but not too much. They can be total slobs. The book is called The Geography of Genius, a search for the world's most creative places, from ancient Athens to Silicon Valley. And Eric Weiner is joining us today to talk about it. He's a writer, a journalist, a longtime foreign correspondent for NPR. You probably remember him there. And he's joining us today from NPR in Washington. Eric Weiner, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Doug.
Well, let's start with how you got started. Because you say in the book you've been thinking about this for a while now. In fact, here's how you describe your interest. I'm fascinated by the subject of genius in much the way a naked man is fascinated by the subject of clothing. What do you mean?
Yeah, it means I'm no genius. Right. But I have aspirations. You know, we all do. Maybe not to be another Einstein or Mozart, but to be a bit smarter and really a bit more creative, because that's how I'm defining genius here, not as someone with a high IQ, at least not that only, but someone who contributes something. So, just as in The Geography of Bliss, I was and still am an essentially unhappy person looking for the world's happiest places, but I was motivated. And as a non-genius, I'm motivated by this thing we call genius.
Yeah. And not just you. I mean, you figure, okay, maybe there's time for me, but you have a lot of hope for your daughter, who was 9 at the time you started. Is she still 9? Is she, where is she now?
Well, actually, it's a funny thing happens is each year they get older.
Yeah, I'm wondering how old she is these days.
Yeah, she's 11 now.
Oh, wow.
And the thing is, we say we just want our kids to be happy. That's a total lie. We don't. We want them to be geniuses,
yeah,
right? Otherwise, why would we have these little Einsteins and little Mozarts and the gifted and talented track and all these accelerated programs? And it is too late for me. It's probably too late for you too. Nothing personal there, but it's not too late for her. And I realized that and my family, we are the ones that are shaping and molding her.
Yeah.
And, I believe that if charity begins at home, so does creative genius.
Mm. Well, she's adopted from Kazakhstan. So right. You're going to forget the genetic part of that, which you sort of put aside anyway in the book, and we'll talk a little bit about that.
And it's just as well she didn't get my genes. So you're right.
So you and your wife are dealing with the nurture part.
Exactly.
And you figure sort of in some ways this is the part that really matters the most, that environment, right?
I fall squarely on the nurture side of this, and I think increasingly the evidence shows that something like creative genius is not hereditary.
Yeah.
You know, back in the 19th century, there was a book by a British scientist named Francis Galton called Hereditary Genius, and that's what he said, is it's all hereditary, you know. And in fact, you know, a genius has never begot another genius, and I'm not discounting genetics. They're part of the mix, but I think they're not nearly as big of a part as we think. And I say this being fully aware that I'm a place person. I view the world through the prism of place, through environment, through nurture. So I'm hoping my book will be kind of a corrective to this notion that geniuses are born.
You say we suffer from a case of genius inflation. We throw that term around a lot, it seems, these days.
We do. You know, everyone's a marketing genius or a sports genius. Yeah. A toothbrush company has just come out with a toothbrush called The Genius that uses GPS tracking to check your brushing technique, you know. So
that's pretty smart.
Smart, but, you
But is
know,
that genius, right?
Exactly. Essentially, if everyone's a genius, then nobody's a genius.
Right.
I think we have diluted the term. I think it doesn't mean what it used to mean. And I think we toss it around rather promiscuously.
Your favorite definition comes from the scientist Margaret Bowden. Here it is. Here's genius. The ability to come up with ideas that are new, surprising, and valuable.
Yeah.
Is that a good... I mean, you work through it in the book, but that's a good place to start, at least on that level, I guess.
I think so. You know, we tend to focus on the new and surprising part of that equation, where we're into shock effect and something has to be radically new. But it needs to be useful also, or valuable, or at least appreciated in the case of a work of art. And the surprising part of that equation, in other words, new, surprising, and valuable, is important. You know, the German philosopher Schopenhauer was asked about the difference between talent and genius, and he said that talent hits the target no one else can hit. Genius hits the target no one else can see. Mm. So there's that leap. There's always that conceptual leap. And I would add to what Schopenhauer said and say that once the genius has hit that invisible target, it needs to become visible to everybody else, right? Otherwise, you're just some crazy dude off hitting invisible targets, you know, that no one can see. In other words, genius ultimately is a social verdict, and we as a society decide who's a genius and who isn't.
Yeah. Explain that more, because I think this is an interesting part. I mean, this idea of, like, Prince, the musician.
Right. Right.
Was Prince a genius? I mean, when you hear people talking about his life since his unfortunate end a few weeks ago, it seems like, at least right now, there's some kind of consensus that he was pretty special, but a genius.
Yeah, which makes him a genius. Well, first of all, let's look at that definition, those criteria of new, surprising, and valuable.
Right.
His music was new, but... You know, there's new and then there's that leap. So it was surprising to a lot of people. And it was valuable in the sense that we appreciated it. So I would say, yes, he was a genius because the people have voted or tweeted or however we vote today and said and decided as a society that this guy was a genius. Now, why is Prince considered a genius and not Thomas Addis, who you probably haven't heard of, who is one of the best-known classical composers and most accomplished classical composers of our day? Well, I would say it's because, you know, we get the geniuses that we want and that we deserve.
Right.
And what we want right now is the music of a Prince or a David Bowie. We've been losing a lot of geniuses lately.
Yeah.
But we don't necessarily appreciate or at least elevate the classical composers to the level of genius the way they were in, say, Mozart's time.
But this gets us to a really important point that you say that this is about culture.
Yes.
That's, you say, in a word, you're speaking of culture. When we're talking about like the essence of this, it's a, explain that. Why is culture so crucial?
Because, okay, we're talking about place.
Yeah.
But what do we mean by place? Do we mean the weather? Well, no, not really, because ancient Athens was very sunny and beautiful as it is today. That might explain Socrates and Plato, but then Shakespeare did his work under a dreary English sky. So
right,
it's not
right.
just weather. Topography is part of it,
yeah.
but topography shapes culture. Culture is essentially, you know, the classic definition of our shared values and norms. It's the glue that holds us all together. As soon as you have two people in a room, or they don't even need to be in a room these days, they can be online and creating an online culture. Whenever you have two people communicating and connecting, you have a culture.
Right.
And it's out of that culture, I believe, that geniuses spawned.
Let's talk about one of the people that you come back to from time to time in the book. It's the person who was the founders, one of the founders anyway, of this field of, and I had no idea there was a field called geniusology.
Yes.
Dean Symington. He's a terrific character. Talk about him.
Well, it turns out he's been studying this all his life.
Yeah.
In fact, since he was 5 years old and fascinated, the way some kids are fascinated with playing cards, baseball cards, that sort of thing, he was fascinated with geniuses and with the where and the why of geniuses. He has a very mathematical, computational mind, very good at integral calculus and that sort of thing, but he's applied it to the field of psychology. And so he has not only really pioneered this field of creatology, of geniusology, but also an even more obscure field called historiometrics. Mm-hmm. And what they do, historiometricians, if that's the word, is they essentially look back at these golden ages, these pinpoints of time and place in history that really flourished, and they will attempt to figure out what was going on. But they will attempt to do it not just anecdotally, but mathematically,
yeah.
scientifically. And he's done some fascinating work finding out what is going on in these places.
He's one of the first ones you went to. What did he say to look for? What was sort of the guidance he gave you as you started to travel and figure this stuff out?
Well, not to have too many assumptions,
yeah.
I think. You know, I'll just give you one off the top of my head, is we tend to assume that these places of genius, these golden ages, are kind of like a paradise. You know, picture the Renaissance, the Italian Renaissance. You have these images of people lounging about and painting beautiful artwork and eating grapes, I don't know, something like that. But in fact, all of these places that I examined, these genius clusters, were difficult places.
Yeah.
They were not paradise at all.
Athens and, was a dump, I think. It was a total dump,
even by the dumpy standards of the day.
Right.
I mean, and it was not the nicest place. It had a chaotic flavor to it. It was dirty. The walls were so thin that robbers can merely just dig through a wall to
yeah.
steal things. And the ancient Greek word for robber means literally one who digs through walls. So that's what it was like.
And it didn't smell very well either.
No, the stench was terrific. And as it was in Enlightenment Edinburgh. So
yeah,
maybe there's yeah. a theme there, you know,
yeah.
genius stinks.
Wait, chaos is a theme, Eric, right? I mean, that seems like if there's one thing that unifies all of these together, it does seem like disorder and chaos is a theme. Yes.
Right. You know, Graham Greene once said bitingly of the Swiss, 500 years of peace and stability. And what have they brought the world but the cuckoo clock, which is a little, well, it's sort of unfair
yeah.
to the Germans, actually, who invented the cuckoo clock, not the Swiss. But his point is well taken. All of these creative places have a sense of disorder to them, not anarchy.
No.
There's a difference between anarchy and chaos. In chaos, there are actually, chaos is kind of a transitional stage between two orders. And if you think about it, we need that in order to come up with new ideas. You know, there was a neuroscientist named Walter Freeman who did this fascinating study looking at the brains of rabbits. And he would hook up their brains to EEGs. No rabbits were harmed in the making of these experiments, by the way. And then he would introduce them to odors, to smells. And some the rabbits were familiar with and some they were not. And when they were introduced to a new odor, something very interesting happened. Their brains entered a chaotic state, what Freeman called an I-don't-know state, before eventually settling down into a new order. So in order to get from an old idea to a new one, you need to pass through a phase of chaos.
You know, what's interesting about Athens in the chaotic way, it's almost as if the Athenians built into the structure of their society disorder. Like, they were not entirely comfortable with the idea of things being too orderly. And it seems like they figured disorder would challenge them intellectually. Yes?
Yeah. I don't know if they how consciously they did that, but that was the end result. Yeah. There was a fluidity to life, and you would see it in the agora in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. You know, you visit Athens today, and everybody wants to go to the Acropolis, and it's beautiful, and it is the crowning achievement of Athens, at least under the ruler Pericles. But the real heart of the city, the real intellectual heart of the city, was the agora, or marketplace, where everybody went to trade goods and ideas. It's where Socrates hung out. Mm-hmm. It was this chaotic public space. And, you know, there's a sociologist who named Ray Oldenburg who's given a name to these places. He calls them third places.
Yeah.
A third place is not work, first place, or home, second place, but it's a public sphere where you have people of different classes and backgrounds coming together. And today, our third places are not the agora. They tend to be coffee shops,
yeah,
like Starbucks, but others as well, where people can come and interact and ideas can get mixed up. You know, it's been said of cities, and I think this is actually quite true, that cities are where ideas go to have sex. And that was true in Athens, and that's true of cities today.
Yeah, that's an important one. Florence, too. I mean, these were bustling marketplaces where people of different classes, different cultures gather together. It seems like that stew is important.
It is important. You know, when you get like-minded people together, the result is often groupthink. You know, that's what happened during the Bay, just before the Bay of Pigs invasion, when Ken and his advisors all suggested that this was the right course of action. We now know it wasn't. But that's considered the classic case of groupthink. Now, what I was really curious about researching this book is, why is it when you get some people together, the result is groupthink? When you get another group of people together, the result is genius.
Yeah.
You know, you can see it going both ways. I think it actually has to do with dissent, with the degree of dissent that's permitted. And when you have dissenting views, even if they're completely wrong, I mean, someone can have a dissenting view that's just way out there, completely wrong, that's going to ultimately lead to more creative ideas and solutions.
Complacency is a killer, it seems. That's
complacency,
that
and it's close cousin arrogance,
right.
I would say, yeah. If you think about it, all creativity requires a degree of ignorance, right? You need to know what you don't know. I don't want to get old Donald Rumsfeldian, but, you know, you have your known knowns and your unknown unknowns, but you need to know that there's stuff you don't know.
Yeah.
And if you think you know it all, you're not a know-it-all, in fact, and you're unlikely to come up with some creative idea or some creative solution. So arrogant people and places have decided they know it all and they've closed themselves off. Don't get me wrong, a degree of self-confidence is important, and people, geniuses like Einstein and Mozart, were supremely self-confident, but they always, I think, retained a degree of ignorance, this idea that there is something out there yet to be discovered. And the places that I looked at, because that's really what I was interested in, these places of genius, in their heyday, they were bustling, they were self-confident, but they weren't arrogant. And once they turned arrogant, you could see the slide. You could see the decline. That's what happened in Athens.
Yeah. So how did you pick this? We'll get to the cities you eventually chose. You didn't choose Elizabethan London, which I thought was interesting. You didn't choose like Paris, for example,
yeah,
in the 20s. I mean, you had a lot of options. I guess you had to pick some.
I did. The French are a bit sore about that. I've heard from them. No, seriously.
Yeah.
They're like, you know, the honest truth is Woody Allen's movie Midnight in Paris had just come out. And I thought, oh, 1920s Paris. I cannot follow on the heels of Woody Allen. This is way too obvious.
Yeah.
And in fact, there's some truth to that. I wanted a mix of places, and I wanted some places that were well-known to most readers, like ancient Athens, yep. Renaissance Florence. And I wanted some places that were sort of in the middle tier, such as Vienna during the time of Mozart, or the time of Freud, for that matter, Edinburgh, Scotland, during the Scottish Enlightenment. And then I wanted some places that were really, were places of genius, but were not at all familiar to most of my readers, such as Hangzhou, China, yeah. during the Song Dynasty.
I loved that one.
And in Calcutta, India, during what's now known as the Bengal Renaissance. And then I wanted to bring the book back home. And the question was where in, you know, say 20th, 21st century America would be considered a place of genius. And I considered New Orleans and jazz and New York in the art scene in the 50s and the 60s, and even briefly considered Detroit during its heyday, but ultimately concluded that I had to go to Silicon Valley, yeah. that that was and is the place that we today associate, particularly with American genius.
So only one from the modern era, really. What does that tell you?
A couple things. One is that we need some distance, I think,
yeah.
to judge whether some place is really a place of genius. You know, it just like we need distance from the creator. We were talking a few minutes ago about Prince and whether he was a genius or not. Ask me in 20 or 30 years, yeah. and we'll see if the, you know, if the consensus is gelled or not. So we need that. And I really do believe that we're not living in a golden age of genius. I know people might take exception with that, but I think we have narrowed the definition. And we consider, many people consider, say, Steve Jobs a genius. So if it's a social verdict, so be it. But these hotspots today tend to be kind of one-note towns. Silicon Valley does one thing very well, technology. And you see other places that maybe do art well. But the real golden ages of the past were, the sparks were flying in many different directions. In Athens and Florence and Edinburgh, Scotland, you had poetry and art and science and social science and literature, all of this going on at the same time. And you don't see that very often these days. We live in an age of specialization. And as I conclude, specialization really is the enemy of creative genius.
We'll get to this question near the end because you raise it. Are we... Is this the end of golden ages, especially in a digital age, in a time when you gather differently? Don't answer it yet.
Because okay.
We'll get to
All
it. Right. I think towards the end. It's a really big question. Eric Weiner is with us. His book is The Geography of Genius. We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the journalist Eric Weiner is joining us to explain how you create a genius, which is not that easy, of course, and what exactly is genius anyway. In his latest book, he tracks down the things that most geniuses have in common. They're social and competitive. They tinker. Sometimes they drink. They live in loud, noisy cities. And that's the most important part of this is place. Weiner scanned the map and he identified these genius clusters, Athens and Florence and Vienna, Silicon Valley. His book is called The Geography of Genius, and he's joining us to talk about it today. I want to come back to Athens because I loved this part. And we should say that it's a terrific bit of writing, and you have so much fun in it. It's not just you sort of digging in looking for these studies. You have these companions that you hook up with at various times, you know, tour guides who show you
overqualified tour guides, I should add. I mean, most of them have master's or PhDs in archaeology or art history. So, yeah, they were that sort of tour guide. And, I just figure, as we've already determined, Doug, I'm not a genius, right? So I rely on the guidance of people who spend lifetimes studying this. And I see my role as kind of an interpreter,
yeah.
Interpreting what maybe social scientists or archaeologists are finding, but can't always put into terms that the rest of us can understand. I do have fun. I think there's nothing wrong with taking a serious subject like creative genius and having some fun with it.
Aristotle was the name of your guy in Athens, strangely enough. And I wanted to ask you about your experience in Athens. Right when you get there, you think, gosh, the light here is different. Maybe it's the light. Turns out it probably wasn't, but and you already mentioned that climate may have played something in some of this, but that
probably wasn't. Yeah. I mean, you know, the light is so sharp and severe in Athens that it creates these shadows and this sharp distinction between dark and light. And you can't help but wonder, you know, this is where logic came of age, the whole notion of logical thinking. Did the light play a role? This is where a painter named Apollodorus developed the first technique for creating the illusion of depth by using shadows. Did that play a role? So I guess my point is that something like the light or the climate ultimately gets fused with the culture, right? Yeah. This all feeds into this thing we call culture. So, you know, in Shakespeare, in dreary old England, maybe the lack of light affected him in some way. But it's not like you can say, oh, if you want to have a creative place, you need sunshine or you need clouds or that sort of thing.
It's interesting that we say ancient Greece, but there were a lot of Greeces, as you point out. Athens wasn't the richest. It wasn't the most powerful. It's surprising in some ways that it turned out to be they borrowed a lot. So maybe they borrowed some of these ideas that they just made a little bit better, more interesting. What was it about Athens as you were learning? As Aristotle, your guide, thought it was politics and free speech, but I don't know. You saw it as more complicated than that.
Yeah, I think it was. You rightfully point out there were actually a lot more than I thought. There were hundreds and hundreds, close to 1,000 of these Greek city-states. And these were not like towns or cities in the U.S. today. They were like more state than city, right? They had their own culture, their own dialect of Greek, their own way of doing things. And, you know, we were talking about topography. Well, they grew up partly because of the mountainous, hilly terrain in that part of Greece. And so naturally sort of, you know, in a day before high-speed rail and Skype, they sort of formed their own cultures. And so it was a perfect, like, petri dish. You know, you had lots of different cultures going on. And why Athens? It's funny. I was surprised at how few classicists who study this actually thought about that. You know, Aristotle, my guide, as opposed to the philosopher, was a bit befuddled, to be honest, because it's not the question most people ask. They just want to, you know, gaze at the Acropolis, at the Parthenon. But I think you touched upon something big, which was the Athenians were great borrowers. They were moochers, right? Yeah. They sailed. They were great sailors. And they sailed to Egypt and to Mesopotamia. And they borrowed or stole statue making or mathematics. And then they perfected it. As Plato said, what the Greeks borrow from foreigners, they perfect. And this is a theme I realized in all of these creative places, right up to Silicon Valley today. Yeah. We associate Silicon Valley so much with innovation and new ideas and new inventions. But in fact, very little was actually invented there. Not the cell phone, for instance, that came out of Illinois, or the notion of venture capital that actually came out of New York. But just like the ancient Athenians in Silicon Valley, what they borrow or steal from others, they perfect. And so these places are not always, these golden ages are not always places where new ideas are born, but they're places where the ideas learn how to walk and run.
Right. In China, in Hangzhou, China, and this is an important part of the story there. As the chapter heading puts it, genius is nothing new. And you say that Chinese creativity from that era, from that time, is not a break from tradition, but a continuation of that.
From that era and right up to today as well.
Would you talk about that? Because it seems like, this seems like the creative act, I really like this part, was not about invention, as you put it. It was about discovery. And there's an important distinction there.
Right. And this, you know, not to get too metaphysical here, but our notions of creativity are tied to our creation myths, right? Yeah. And we live in a Judeo-Christian country. Whether or not you are religious or not, you have absorbed some of these beliefs. And one of them is this idea of creation ex nihilo, literally from nothing, that you can create something from nothing, which is, I think, why we are so enamored of at least the illusion of something brand new, never seen before. While in Chinese cosmology, the creation myth is that, in fact, there's always been something called the Tao, or the universe, the way. And so the creative person is, in a way, rediscovering what's already there, rearranging what's already there, which to our Western ears maybe sounds less creative, but the Chinese don't see it that way. So they really put an emphasis on, you know, if you look at those three criteria we were talking about earlier for what makes for something, any work of genius has to be new, surprising, and valuable. Well, we focus on the new and surprising part. The Chinese did and still do focus on the valuable part. Is this invention useful? And, you know, all innovation is evolutionary, not revolutionary. It's all a continuation from something that came before. Now, some of it may be more of a leap than others, but there's always a connection to the previous dot.
You met with Jack Ma.
Yep, yep.
Founder of Alibaba. Most people know that name. He's pretty wealthy these days. What is it, $26
billion? $26.9 billion. When I met him, his company had not yet gone public, so he was only worth $3
billion. Yeah.
So I think that's how I was able to finagle a meeting with him. I probably wouldn't have a chance today.
You probably wouldn't.
And he shows up for the meeting in a sweatsuit, looking very casual, which I guess you could do when you're worth, you know, somewhere between $3 and $27 billion. But a very nice man. With a great, you know, backstory about how he became so successful. And he's actually from Hangzhou, this city that thrived in the 13th century. And lo and behold, you know, all these centuries later, the wealthiest and some would say most creative man to emerge from China is also hailed from there.
Well, we should mention something about Hangzhou, because you say when the Europeans were picking lice out of their hair, the Chinese of that Song dynasty, that era, that sort of really special 300-year or so period, were inventing and writing and painting and discovering. And we should say, this is how you put it in the book, that era really changed the way we navigate the world.
Yes, literally, because they invented the compass, you know, some several hundred years before Christopher Columbus reinvented it, essentially. And it wasn't just the compass. There were all sorts of scientific discoveries at the time. There was great poetry and art coming out of Hangzhou. And, you know, it was a city of at least 1 million people, right? And we're talking in the 11th, 12th, 13th century. You know, the biggest city in Europe at the time, say Marco Polo's Venice, was, you know, maybe 50,000 people. So it was a huge difference. And in fact, Marco Polo visited Hangzhou during its heyday and was blown away. He was absolutely blown away by what he saw. And to such an extent that when he wrote about it in his diaries, people back home in Europe didn't believe him. They thought he was making it up.
Jack Ma is, when you're talking to him, he's really worried about the country's education system. He thinks it's killing Chinese creativity. And then he says something that startles you. He says that China has lost its culture and its religion. What was he getting at there?
This did surprise me because he actually spoke of religion in particular. Taoist, Buddhist, Confucian religion, and that the Chinese need to return to these religious and cultural roots if they want to be creative. Look, there's a lot of hand-wringing in China right now about what they call the innovation gap. You know, the complaint goes something like this. Everything is made in China, but nothing is invented there. And there is some truth to that. But Jack Ma thinks that this exam system, which actually began in the Song Dynasty for good reasons, to sort of eliminate nepotism from the system. You know, now you took an exam and that determined who got ahead. It was a sort of meritocratic approach, has sort of devolved into this mindless exercise that Chinese have to learn everything by rote, cram for the exam, talk about study for the test, or what do they say? Teach to the test. They say here. Yeah. That's all they do in China. And Jack Ma thinks that's sort of sucking the life out of Chinese creativity, and he thinks they, instead of imitating the West, they need to return to their own roots, or I would say probably find a hybrid. I think Jack Ma himself, I don't know if he would agree with this, but I think he's a bit of a hybrid individual himself. You know, he was hanging out in Hangzhou in, you know, the 1970s, after Nixon's visit, after the country was just opening up to the West, and he would meet these American and foreign tourists, didn't speak a word of English, and he would give people free tours of the city in exchange for sort of impromptu English lessons. And that must have affected him some way, you know, young and impressionable and meeting these more entrepreneurial Americans. And he starts an internet company, not that different from Amazon. So I think he's probably sort of a combination of East and West.
The role that money might play in genius. When we get back from a break, Eric Weiner is with us. His book is The Geography of Genius. We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Eric Weiner. We're talking about his book, The Geography of Genius, A Search for the World's Most Creative Places from Ancient Athens to Silicon Valley. Florence isn't exactly a spot you'd pick for geniuses. You mentioned it was prone to malaria, really swampy. It had the bubonic plague, lots of fires and floods. But, of course, the Renaissance really, as you say, shined brightest there. And the question is why? And one of the answers you found in a gold coin. Would you talk about that?
And that gold coin is the florin, the currency of the day, the first international currency ever. And, you know, we don't often think of money and geniuses having much to do with each other. You know, and there's some truth to this in that, you know, a physicist named Lord Rutherford once said, we have no money, so we will have to think. Yeah. So there is that. And this is one of the themes of my book, the idea of constraints that, right, you know, you need to push against something. But you need some resources, right? A starving artist doesn't really produce anything except for their own misery. And, you know, as was once said of Mahatma Gandhi, one of his aides said, oh, it takes a lot of money to keep the Mahatma in poverty. And likewise, it takes a lot of money to keep a starving artist starving. They need patrons. And really, the lesson from Renaissance Florence is not just the lesson of Leonardo and Michelangelo. It's the lesson really of the Medicis, the family that were the patrons of Renaissance Florence, and the money that they had. They were a banking family. The wealth actually started, you know, in the 14th, 15th century, came from the cloth trade. Mm-hmm. They had none of the natural resources for the cloth trade in Florence. They had to import the wool from England and the pigments, the dyes as far away as Afghanistan. But they had the know-how, and they had this very discerning eye. This is and was and is a very Florentine characteristic. It's kind of a pickiness almost, but it's really a discernment. It's seeing, you know, everything, something that's just a little bit off really bugs a Florentine. And that was true of the Medicis too. And they were great talent scouts. And they don't get as much credit as the Michelangelos do, but I think they deserve it.
Well, what was interesting about that, the Medici family was, as you point out in the book, it wasn't just about their own private desires. Their patronage was, they had the public interest in mind. They cared about beauty. They had a bigger, I think it seems like they had a bigger sense of the world.
Right. And they were not patronizing as some patrons can be. Yeah. And they were not in it just for the personal glory. Yes, that was part of it. But they really got art. And they recognized talent. You know, one of my favorite tales from that time is that of Lorenzo de' Medici, a.k.a. Lorenzo the Magnificent, who's one day is outside of the sort of Medici palace grounds in the gardens where there are various stone cutters and statue making going on. And he spots a 14-year-old boy who's making a statue of a Roman god. And he says, well, that's, you know, that's pretty good, but he didn't quite get the teeth right. And the next day, Lorenzo comes back and notices this 14-year-old kid has fixed it and perfected this statue, and Lorenzo takes him under his wing and gives him the best teachers, the best materials in the land, and it was an investment, and it was a wise investment, because today that kid is best known as Michelangelo. And you saw this time and again in Renaissance Florence.
You went to Edinburgh, and you see you were struck right away as you walked along the streets there in Scotland that Scottish genius is somehow different. You say it's quirky and social and informal, and here's the critical part, it's practical.
Right.
That's an important part of genius, this, at least in this cluster, practicality.
Yeah, the Scots were the great improvers. Right. You know, they always wanted to improve something. We know about James Watt and his steam engine. He didn't actually invent the steam engine. He improved it, but right. improved it dramatically. So the Scottish Enlightenment really began on the farm, actually, with the invention of a new kind of plow. And then it spread from there. But it was always looking at something and saying, how can we do this better? And it was sort of the marriage of ideas and down and dirty practicality. And it found its perfect expression in medicine.
Yep.
And if you think about that, this makes sense, because medicine requires what? It requires some theoretical knowledge of how the body works and chemistry, et cetera. But it also is very hands-on. So at this time, we're talking 18th century, if you got sick, you wanted to be in Edinburgh. It's where the best doctors and hospitals were and a thriving medical school.
One of the questions you ask is about the Scottish universities. What was it about them that made them genius factories? Because it seems like you were headed one way in the book. Because in Florence, they didn't have great universities. And in fact, you know, this seems to be a dynamic of geniuses, is that in education didn't seem to matter. But for some reason for the Scots, they figured it out, at least at this point.
Right. In fact, usually education would get in the way of genius,
yeah,
actually.
Right.
You are statistically less likely to become a genius if you have a PhD than if you don't.
Yeah.
Right. So, and it sounds strange, but it makes sense, because the genius is always rocking the boat, and the extent to which the university is part of that boat, you know, that's going to be a problem. In Scotland, they got a few things right. One is the university system was actually very entrepreneurial. The professors worked on commission. The more students they attracted to the class, the more they got paid. That might be an interesting approach today, now that I think about it. And it was a very two-way sort of teaching process. By that, I mean Adam Smith, the father of economics and capitalist theory, really, tested his ideas out on his class, which consisted of a group of 14-year-olds. And these ideas ultimately became his classic, The Wealth of Nations. And I think the Scots really had a very robust form of conversation that probably took place in the classroom as well. And they have this term called flighting, F-L-Y-T-I-N-G. Have you heard of it?
No.
It's the definition, as explained to me by a Scottish historian, is ritual humiliation of your opponent through verbal violence, which sounds horrific, or like a Republican debate. I don't know. I was kind of taken aback, because he said it with a real twinkle in his eye, ritual humiliation of your opponent through verbal violence. And the key is that during a flighting session, you can say anything about your opponent or about his ideas. But afterwards, there are no hard feelings, and you head down to the local pub for a pint or 10. And I think that's the difference between then and now. I think, you know, we might do plenty of humiliating of our opponents through verbal violence, but we're not likely to be friends afterwards, and therefore we're not able to flight another day, so to speak. So, but seriously, that kind of freewheeling conversation was really at the heart of the Scottish Enlightenment.
How important is it to be social? It seems like there were, I think you point out, there weren't really that many loners in the bunch in terms of geniuses.
No, and they were both. I've come to conclude that geniuses are great togglers, and they will toggle between, say, nature and an urban setting.
Because walks are important. I love that.
Walks are important. Yeah. Beethoven was a really urban creature, a bon vivant, a ladies' man, loved living in Vienna, but he would need to escape on the weekends to the woods called the Wienerwald outside of Vienna and go for these long walks, but then he would need to return. And likewise, David Hume, the philosopher, he would lock himself up in his house for days or weeks on end conducting these thought experiments just in his own mind. And then, as he writes in his diary, he needed desperately to go out into the pub and socialize. So I don't think geniuses are loners to the extent that we think they are. They need to be alone, but they also need companionship.
Yeah. Need an audience, too.
Absolutely. And I think that is key. You know, we think of genius as this one-way flow. The genius just creates something spectacular, and we, the audience, just bow to them and their greatness and just take it in. And it doesn't work that way. It's much more of a two-way conversation, really. Mozart's a good example. Mozart moved from Salzburg to Vienna because that provided him with a bigger and more discerning audience, and they were demanding. Mm-hmm. People knew their music in Vienna at the time, and they demanded a lot from their composers. And so Mozart was always trying to up his game to give people what they wanted and what they would appreciate.
Silicon Valley is an important part of the story. It's sort of where you end up. Is there a decidedly American twist to all of this? This is one of the things you mentioned in that chapter. You said one thing you found is that Americans want to get rich, but they want to do it by saving the world. So is this an American? Is there an American twist on genius?
Yeah, because I think in Silicon Valley there exists a kind of techno-evangelism or techno-evangelism, if you will. Money alone, I think, is never enough of a motivation not to create something that along the lines of a Silicon Valley. I mean, yes, people definitely like money there and would love to get wealthy, but they really do believe that they are changing the world through the redemptive power of technology. It's yeah. almost a religious movement in a way. And I think that's a particularly American approach to genius.
But it seems like one of the conclusions you came to about Silicon Valley was that it really wasn't about the technology. It was really more the medium, but it was more about the way ideas are cultivated.
It's not about technology at all, Silicon
yeah.
Valley. That's just the product, actually,
right.
the end
right.
result. But Silicon Valley is a system.
Yeah.
It is a idea processing system. You go to Silicon Valley with an idea. First of all, you'll get an audience because you're out west. You're more likely to get an audience. And then people will decide, essentially, is this an idea worth pursuing or not? And if it is, you'll be tracked into a system like you need to talk to so-and-so about marketing and so-and-so about raising capital. And so it is actually a very efficient idea processing system.
I like how you end up with this experience of baking bread, because the genius who came up with sourdough bread, and you talk about this really tells us how complicated it is to try and engineer or create genius. So genius or the golden age that makes geniuses, it's hard to predict. But you also say in the book that we can anticipate them and we can learn, you say, to ride the currents that are there. And you say the geniuses that you encountered along the way were really great at surfing those currents. Explain what you mean.
Well, the surfer doesn't invent the wave, right? The wave is happening, and the wave would be the milieu of the time. You know, they're born into this time, and there's a wave coming along. But they've got to choose the right tools, the right surfboard, and they have to have the guts. You know, every once in a while when there's a hurricane coming along, invariably you'll see a local news report while everyone's evacuating, some crazy guy or gal is going out there on a surfboard and surfing. And a lot of them wipe out, but a few of them are able to gauge the waves in order to ride them. And it is a creative process. Yes, surfing, I don't surf, but I imagine that it's a very creative process, but it's one that really requires an attention to your environment, to the wave around you. And, you know, ideas like Einstein's theory of relativity, Freud's theory of the unconscious, brilliant ideas, But they came along in a certain place in a certain time, mm-hmm. With certain waves going on.
Yeah,
and I don't think they would. Yeah, I don't think they would have happened at another time. And then we wouldn't know the names Einstein and Freud.
Mm. That gives us the sense of diversity. You come up with three D's at the end. Discernment is one of them. Diversity is one of them. Disorder is another one. Seems like a good way of summing it.
I might add a fourth, too, which
yeah.
is discomfort,
yeah.
actually. That comfort is really the enemy of creativity. That one of the conclusions I reach is that, you know, creativity is a response to constraints, right? That mm-hmm. we need something to push against. And you see companies these days, with the best of motivations, intentions, giving their employees everything they need, beanbag chairs and free coffee and all that,
yeah.
Thinking now they'll be creative. But in fact, when you look at how these companies were born, like Google or Apple, in garages, mm-hmm. On a shoestring, in other words, with great constraints. So, we need to stay a little bit uncomfortable if we're going to be creative.
So finally, you ask this kind of scary question toward the end of the book. Is Silicon Valley going to be the last great place? Because we're now in a global economy. We now have the internet and a digital revolution. Is this the death of place? You're all about place. Is it the death of place? You don't think so necessarily.
Right. And I'm not only saying that because I write books that tend to have the word geography in the title.
right.
I want to be clear about that.
Yeah.
I don't think it's dead for a number of reasons. One is, have you ever thought about why Silicon Valley continues to exist? It really shouldn't, because they've produced this product of digital technology, Skype, et cetera, which was invented in Estonia, but that's another thing. And so you could be anywhere, right? You could be living and working anywhere. Apple employees could be dispersed around the world. Same with Google. But in fact, most people who are telling us, hey, geography's dead, you can be anywhere, they all tend to live and work in one place called Silicon Valley. So no, geography is not dead.
Eric Weiner, his book, The Geography of Genius, A Search for the World's Most Creative Places from Ancient Athens to Silicon Valley, joined us from NPR in Washington. Eric, thanks very much.
Thanks, Doug. This was fun.
Radio West, production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.